On this week in Enterprise Tech, we talk a bit about over-the-air updates in the auto industry and how technology needs to play a role in the healthcare industry, as well as we have an amazing guest, Brian McHenry from F5 Networks, to talk security and, of course, Black Hat. Twyatt, on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 250, recorded July 28th, 2017. Black Hat 2017.
This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Eero. Never think about Wi-Fi again with Eero's hyper-fast, super-simple Wi-Fi system. And now the second generation Eero is tri-band and twice as fast. For free overnight shipping, visit Eero.com, select overnight shipping at checkout, and enter the code ENTERPRISE. And by Amazon Kinesis from AWS, a powerful new way to easily collect, process, and analyze streaming data so you can get timely insights and react quickly to new information. Learn more at kinesis.aws.
Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host for today, Louis Maresca, your guide through the world of enterprise. But as you know, the world of enterprise is a pretty darn large place. And in order to represent it correctly, I need to pull in another expert in that domain. And that expert is my co-host in crime, Mr. Brian Chi, the director of Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu. Chibert, I hear you got to attend a center workshop lately. Anything coming out of that?
Well, what we're going to be doing in 2 weeks is we're going to be teaching a whole bunch of people that run traditional Hawaiian fish ponds how to do build your own sensors. So the idea is be able to go and figure out what water levels are, oxygen dilution, things like that, so that we can start bringing back some ancient Hawaiian technology.
Fantastic. Sounds exciting. Well, hopefully we'll really interest you today. We have some really interesting topics, and including some things about over-the-air updates and how the auto industry is being affected, as well as how is IT playing a factor in healthcare, and of course, Black Hat. But first, like we always do, let's kick it off with the blips. In the spirit of the Black Hat conference going on right now in Vegas, as well as our guests later on in the show, we had to talk a little bit about how hackers are stealing your credit cards at gas pumps. It's only a matter of time that hackers and thieves found a way to transmit stolen credit card data from more than just ATMs. Investigators in New York found their first encounter with a GSM-based gas pump skimmer. Investigators say skimming gangs typically gain access to station pumps by using a handful of master keys that still open a large number of pumps that are still in use today. To date, most skimmers are on pumps rely basically on Bluetooth components, allowing thieves to collect stolen credit card data from pumps wirelessly with any mobile device. The downside to this approach is that Bluetooth-based skimmers can be detected by anyone with a mobile device. ATMs have seen an upgrade to their skimmers recently, showing that they're using GSM text messages, but they've never actually seen these types on fuel pumps before. The GSM-based skimmers essentially collect the data on the card and immediately transmit it to anywhere in the world using SMS messages. Unless found, the device never had to be recollected or data doesn't need to be siphoned from it. So you essentially see some fraud patterns showing that fuel theft gangs tend to target stations that are close to major highway arteries, those that have older pumps, those that don't have security cameras, and of course, ones that don't have regular inspection security tapes on the pumps. Fuel station owners in the United States had until October 1st, 2017 to install the chip capable readers, but in December 2016, Vitas had delayed the requirements, saying that fuel station owners would now have until October 1st, 2020 to meet that liability deadline. Since some skimming devices are capable of stealing debit card pins as well, it's actually a good idea to avoid paying with a debit card at a pump as well. Next time you go to pay to the pump, you might want to do a double take on the swiping device.
Well, the obituary had to be read. Rest in peace, Flash. Adobe has been threatening to kill off Flash for at least the last 10 years, and according to the Ars Technica story, it looks like they may finally do it. With an ever-increasing number of malware threats, vulnerabilities, and just downright compatibility issues, it looks like Adobe is finally going to put us out of our misery. Downside is that there are still a huge number of websites and systems that still require Flash, which means our suffering isn't over by any stretch of the imagination yet.
In the midst of Title II being revoked by the FCC and putting a damper on net neutrality, a nonprofit organization by the name of American Oversight decided not to take it anymore. This past week, the nonprofit decided to file a lawsuit against the FCC for its refusal to disclose FCC's Ajit Pai's conversations with ISPs about subjects like net neutrality. This past April, it was reported that the American Oversight Agency filed a Freedom of Information Act against asking the FCC for all records related to communications on net neutrality between ISPs and Pai and Pai's people. It asked for correspondence, emails, telephone calls, calendar entries, meeting agendas, and any other records of such communications, which the group says have subsequently been ignored. A quote from the organization, "The FCC has made it clear that they're ignoring feedback from the general public. So we're going to court to find out who they're actually listening to about net neutrality. If this administration is going to let the industry lobbyists rewrite the rules of the internet for millions of Americans, we're going to make them do it in full public view." Will it serve us anything meaningful? We'll see.
In a follow-up story, the House now wants Silicon Valley to testify about net neutrality. Included in the invitation are Google's parent company, Alphabet, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, Comcast, Verizon, AT&T, and Charter Communications. The official topic is ground rules for the internet ecosystem, and the hearing will be held on Thursday, September 7th at 10 a.m. Whether this is a good thing or bad thing is up for debate, but whatever happens, at least the House is asking the opinions of a large number of stakeholders.
Most free enterprise security software systems normally focus on file security, especially incoming files. Well, Kaspersky's is trying to change that with their free offering. It announced this past week that it rolled out Kaspersky's free globally over 4 months, and U.S. will be the first country to actually receive it. The AV suite looks to try and protect computers against malicious software with file, web, instant messenger, and email protection modules. Additionally, any additional modules or features are actually behind a paywall. However, the protection modules use the same engine that the commercial product uses. AV Testing, a third-party testing organization, has rated this particular engine one of the best in the industry. Sound like a great deal? Well, a bit of food for thought. Kaspersky's move comes after a scrutiny of its software at its base in Russia. The U.S. government recently removed the company from its list of approved vendors because of the vulnerability Kaspersky's antivirus software had that could provide the Russian government access to U.S. government systems that use the software. The Washington Post reported, according to the Post, Kaspersky's had strongly denied any ties with the Russian government and has offered corporate and federal guest investigations access to do their investigation. I guess in this case, any protection is better than nothing, or is it?
Well, for my friends that have cochlear hearing implants, the first Apple-compatible cochlear implant hearing aid is now available. While the bulk of the world has had Apple-compatible audio devices, those with cochlear implants have a special need that require audio adapters to utilize devices like telephones, walkie-talkies, and various other audio devices. What Cochlear Limited has done is finally offer a cochlear implant-compatible device specifically designed for eye devices so that the hearing challenge can now take advantage of direct media control from the device over the sound quality of their listening enjoyment. To my friends that have cochlear implants, I say, well, I know what to buy you for Christmas now.
So the Philly-based cable powerhouse is starting to see some negative in the midst of a bunch of upward trends. It's the upward trend of cord cutters causing a downward trend of pay TV subscribers. This past week, Comcast reported that its quarter two showed a net loss of 34,000 pay TV customers. Quarter one of 2017 was even worse for a large set of other pay TV providers, losing an estimated 762,000 pay TV subscribers, which is five times more than they lost during the same period last year. To place this in a bit of perspective, in quarter one, The quarter one has normally been historically pretty strong for TV providers. The larger set of subscribers leaving were from Dish Network and from AT&T, but losses showed across the board, with Comcast being the only one in quarter one to show a net gain. It seems that quarter two has finally shown that cord cutting, no company is actually safe from a provider perspective. But what happened to some of the other providers? Well, Charter claims 90,000 losses compared to their 152,000 losses in the entire year last year, and Verizon reported only 15,000 losses. All those pundits predicting the cord-cutting revolution was the future. Well, it looks like the future has arrived. Well, folks, that does it for the Blips. Next up, we're going to get into the Bites, where we talk a little bit about the auto industry and the IT rule and how it plays in healthcare. But first, we couldn't do This Week in Enterprise Tech without our supporters and our sponsors. And Leo wants to tell you about one. Leo?
If I could just – where did I put my Eero's? Oh, they're in my house and my mom's house. If I may just interrupt for a moment to talk about Eero. I'm a big Eero fan, E-E-R-O. It's the new way to Wi-Fi. It is the best. It is the best. Eero solves the problem. Everybody – the great thing about talking about Eero is everybody already understands the problem that Eero solves. Bad Wi-Fi. We've all got it. Buffering, streams not loading, devices not connecting. And it solves it in the best possible way with a mesh system that is constantly updated, constantly improved. In fact, Eero just came out with their second generation Eero. The base station is tri-band, 2.5 gigahertz and 1.2.4 gigahertz, 2x2 MIMO. It's literally twice as fast, and I can say that because I'm using it. And they also now offer these great Eero beacons, which are fantastic. The Eero beacons plug right into the wall, which makes it really easy to connect to your Eero. The Eero app on your iOS or Android device helps you place those secondary units so you get the best possible throughput, walks you through every step of the process. You can easily, by the way, and I recommend this highly, create and share a guest network so your guests don't have your Wi-Fi password. You control their use. You'll know exactly how many devices are connected at any time. You can check the internet speed. It's always, I think it daily goes in when nobody's using it. Eero's so smart. So it knows when it's not being used. So that's awesome. So it goes out, when it's not being used to check speeds. This is my Eero setup at home. The new Eero Plus has so many features. I could just, the gym's down. See that? Gym is disconnected. So this is the kind of thing you're going to know immediately. It's going to warn you. I could see what's connected. I could see all the devices on my network. I can also name a device. This is the Echo in the gym, and I can assign the device, this I love, to different people. So I'm going to assign this to me. I can say by device if there's filters on it, but I can also say by person, which I really love. If I look at the family profiles, I've created three, one for me, one for my wife, one for our son. I see which devices Michael uses. I can turn on the filters. So only Michael's devices have the filters. You also saw per-device filtering. This is the new Eero Plus, which is fantastic. It protects the whole network against malware, but it also can do specific devices or specific people, do safe search, filter out adult content, illegal or criminal content, or violent content. It really is fantastic. And if Michael's got homework to do, I press the pause button, he's offline. I can even say Echo, pause Michael's internet. Oh, by the way, he can't say Echo, unpause Michael's internet. Only I can unpause his internet. Actually, I probably should unpause it. I don't want to leave him with the internet down. It's easy to add an Eero. It actually walks through the setup. Couldn't be easier. I just love it. And at all times, you know how your network's doing. I know my gym's down. I'm going to go find out why. Probably somebody removed it or something. Look at the download speeds, too. It checks this on a regular basis to let you know if you're getting what you thought. More speed, more range in these new Eeros, the Eero Beacon. And with the addition of that third 5 gigahertz radio, it's twice as fast. You can do more simultaneously. And what's really cool about the Eeros is it automatically adjusts at all times. It reroutes and adjusts traffic throughput. So when you're watching Netflix on one device, it knows, they need a real-time stream over there, and it does it automatically. I just love it. And, of course, unlike a lot of other routers, Eeros are updated all the time. We get new software updates on a regular basis, which gives me kind of a nice feeling of security. This is not like those other companies that make a router and then just ignore it. For free overnight shipping, visit Eero.com, E-E-R-O.com, and at checkout, select overnight shipping. Use our offer code ENTERPRISE. That'll take, you know, make it free, and it'll let them know you saw it on This Week in Enterprise Tech. I can go on and on. As you can see, I am crazy about Eero. I don't hear the dreaded words, Leo, the Wi-Fi's down again. I haven't heard that ever since I put in Eero. I liked it so much I got my mom some Eero. She's way across the country, but I can monitor her network too. Eero.com, Eero. Try it today. Don't forget to use the code ENTERPRISE to get free overnight shipping. Get your Eero fast. Now back to This Week at Enterprise Tech. Gentlemen.
Thanks, Leo, and thanks to Eero for their support. So let's go ahead and jump into the bites. So many have said that Tesla is essentially setting the gold standard for how cars can handle over-the-air updates. And Tesla isn't bounded by any laws to prevent them from rolling out any new features to customers without having dealership or mandatory middleman steps. Tesla codes a new feature. It pushes it out to the cars without any middleman. So why is this a problem for automakers even in 2017? Well, this particular Ars article points out that it could be due to contractual reasons between OEMs and their dealer networks. It's not a technical issue, as Tesla's proven, but the article believes that OEMs can't offer existing customers new features for their vehicles without the car dealerships getting their cut. Let me take it at a different angle from this topic. So remember back in 2015 when GM tried to push the Digital Millennium Copyright Act on consumers? Well, that act has been around since 2000, and it started as an anti-internet privacy legislation. But automakers wanted to use it to try to prevent you from working on your car and make it illegal. Yes, kind of illegal. So since today's vehicles use such large amounts of tech and software, GM wanted to list them as a mobile computing device. So hypothetically, then the law would protect automakers from pesky owners looking to alter any sort of technology in the car. What does this prove? Well, it adds to the fire that cars are already a low profit animal, and car companies have to give dealers a way to add to the profit, other than just extended warranties and nice floor mats. So if nothing goes wrong with the car and standard maintenance is the only means for profit, dealers kind of suffer if the service center doesn't rake it in. So I guess the question here, Cheaper, what's the author trying to get at? Is it a contractual thing? Like, what's going on in the auto industry that they just can't provide technology updates to the vehicles like Tesla's proven? What's going on?
Well, yeah, I think a lot of it is, remember, the auto industry is 100 years old. There's a lot of baggage that they're dragging along, and they've had to make lots and lots and lots of promises to their dealerships. Because if we go back into the time of our grandparents, they were very few car dealerships. It was tough to buy a car because there just weren't that many dealerships. So the car manufacturers had to make lots of promises to help guarantee, you know, from things like financing to literally kickbacks. You know, Ford Motor Corporation or GM or whoever's, the financing actually has what they call a stipend for salespeople that get customers to finance their cars. You know, when I bought my Volkswagen, we negotiated, went crazy, and then I wrote a check for the car. You know, because I had a home equity loan, I'd rather be able to claim my interest. You should have seen the salesperson's face. It looked like the kid was going to cry, because apparently I took a lot of money off the table for him. These are the kinds of promises that the car manufacturers have made to the dealerships in order to get them to open dealerships in places where the consumers want them. Well, the problem is, they're taking it far enough that over the air, even though some of the cars are capable, like the Ford Motor Corporation entertainment systems in my wife's vehicle, some of the features can be updated over the air. But we still got hit by recalls for just some reprogramming, which means we had to go in, and the dealership was hoping and praying that we're going to go and coordinate it with, say, an oil change or checkup or something like that, so that they can go and make their profits. So the unfortunate thing is the current automakers have this baggage. Tesla doesn't. But it is my opinion that a lot of the large automakers are seeing the writing on the wall and consumers are demanding over-the-air updates. In fact, one of my major decision points on my next vehicle is going to be over-the-air, and right now that's Tesla. So we'll see. My the first Teslas were supposed to ship today, be handed over today, and supposedly early next week I find out where in line I am for my Tesla Model 3 reservation.
Right. So it's interesting because GM just recently hired a chief data officer, and they've always kind of collected data via their OnStar network. I mean, that network has been around for a while, and it does also have kind of over-the-air capabilities, especially for the car. It can pull telemetry data from your car, whether the car's locked, it's not locked, how your engine's doing, that kind of thing. So it's not like you were saying, I mean, it's not like it's a technology restriction, even though there's a lot, the car industry is pretty old and it does have a lot of baggage. You would think that the technology is there, and that kind of proves that it is. So, it's not that they just can't do it. I'm sure they could probably do it. I'm sure it's just a flip of a switch. It just seems like there is something holding them back, and most likely it is the profit animal that they call, you know, that happens when it comes to dealerships. I think they just need a way to provide, hey, go to the dealership, pay $250 to get your system updated or to get your computer chip in your car updated, you know, and so they kind of get a way to kind of pay it back to get more profit out of it. Go ahead.
No, I'm just going to say, you know, Harman Kardon, one of the largest manufacturers of automotive systems, has had OTA capabilities in their systems, at least for the last 5 or 6 years. It's just that then the OEMs, the big OEMs, aren't taking them up on it. Right. So, Emily, yes, I'm not Mr. Moneybags. I've got a 10-year-old Volkswagen Golf that, you know, it needs to be replaced someday in the relatively near future. I think a Tesla is going to be great because it's probably going to be the last car I'm ever going to buy. And OTA just happens to be one of the features that I'm going to demand when I, you know, start looking at cars.
Right. I think an interesting take on this, and maybe a question back to you, Cheever, is, you know, I kind of feel like, you know, with the onset of, with the kind of innovations of autonomous vehicles, it's almost like the OTA has to become a standard, because if it doesn't, how are these particular vehicles going to be updated? I mean, how are they going to continue to improve the AI on these vehicles to handle different sensor arrays and different types of environments and, you know, that kind of thing? So I kind of throw it back to you, Cheever. Do you think that, you know, by not having this technology across the board, that these companies are kind of hindering innovation on the vehicles?
Actually, I'm not sure I'm really would say hindering innovation. I would definitely say, though, that the car dealerships need to get on board. They need to eat this learning curve. The designers need to eat the learning curve. They need to get the experience that Tesla has been getting for the last, you know, half a dozen years or so. And the reality is yes, I totally agree with you. Self-driving, you know, the various flavors of self-driving, you know, even if it's just a fancy-dancy cruise control that has lane keeping or auto braking and things like that, this is all software. We're both programmers, or at least, you know, I used to be a programmer. Lou is definitely a programmer. And humans make mistakes, and we find bugs all the time, and we need to be able to fix them. Does that mean we have to wait, you know, 3 months, 6 months, or whatever, until the next vehicle checkup for the dealership to go and stick a USB key in to the car computer to do an update? No, that's just not going to buy it, especially when safety's on the table. Right. Over the air has absolutely positively got to happen, and the dealerships and the designers have to get on board, and they need to get that experience, and they're not getting it at the moment.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting topic. I mean, you basically pointed out, I mean, I've seen, you know, many examples in the wild of software companies supplying an update, you know, whether it's, you know, a big download or whatnot, and then it causes kind of an epidemic of, you know, onset of other issues. And in order for them to correct that, they need a quick way to almost patch that issue. And, you know, in this case right now, what happens is if you go get an update on your vehicle and then you leave, essentially you start seeing symptoms, you have to take it back right to the vehicle, to the company, and it causes issues. And if you try to do your own update, it does a whole bunch of other problems. So I think there's causes lots of problems there as well. Another thing too that kind of think about, and I get your thoughts on this as well, Cheever, is, you know, a lot of the car companies are saying that it's obviously due to security as well. We've seen many examples in the past, especially like, for instance, the researchers who took over the Jeep and kind of drove it into a ditch there. I think the car companies are kind of afraid of the ability to do over the air in case somebody can do different types of attacks on the vehicle in order to not only take over the data transmission, but also do kind of denial of service attacks and so on. Do you think that this is something that's also kind of preventing, or we're again just going right back to the fact that it's the profit machine?
Yeah, again, profit. You know, this is the Jeep was actually attacked through the entertainment system, and also because Jeep, they're using a open APN, for God's sakes. You know, this is old technology. Just ask someone in the chat room, like HiWeb, that understands this kind of thing. Private APNs are not hard. I got AT&T to set one up for my research project, and that instantly blocked everybody in the world off from my research project except the modems in my research project. Not hard to do. There's a lot of things that people can do already for IoT, and the automakers are not eating the learning curve. They need to eat the learning curve. They need to get data specialists in. They need to get security specialists in. You know, maybe JJ to the 4884 can go and work for people like GM or his favorite car company and help them secure it. This is not rocket science anymore. IoT needs to grow up. And the IoT on four wheels needs to grow up faster.
Right. Yeah, in fact, back in college, I mean, years ago, I did it actually a senior design project for Dana Corp, which is actually part of the Ford motor industry. And we built, a single board computer that pulled sensor data from the universal joints on four-wheel drive vehicles to get noise and the angle that the joint was going on. And that was able to transmit it back over the vehicle's communication. And so even back then, years ago, 14, 15 years ago, it was capable of doing it. So I'm sure that hopefully the industry will at some point just push them forward, Well, folks, that does it for that bite. Let's move on to the next one. So similar to how the costs and profit hounds are possibly preventing the auto industry from moving forward, it seems that in the healthcare industry, we also have it's also been hindered by the lack of technology use as well. Now, it's no surprise that the U.S. specifically is definitely ahead in the use of technology in medicine and health, especially in light of the fact that we hear many stories about people trying to come to the U.S. for advanced treatments and healthcare. It's really the healthcare side itself that's lacking in the use of technology and IT to bring the industry closer and have better transparency with not only consumers, but also providers, and provide a way to reduce costs up front. So there are also some doctors and providers have systems to communicate to their patients and have patients communicate back. And some of them also provide a way for people to review their medical history, although it's not necessarily standardized just yet. It would be nice if another provider would need to communicate data back and forth between each other. They wouldn't have to actually fax it to each other. There is an ongoing effort, the electronic health record mandated by the Affordable Care Act, which is helping some of the efforts, but there's still a bunch of structural problems. To increase some of the visibility and remove some of the stress for actually visiting the doctor and providing more transparency on the data, there are telehealth systems like Doctor on Demand and Teladoc and Avizia and CareClix, and they're using modern platforms for video doctor consultation as ways to provide specialized mobile technology in order to acquire data from the patient in order to do a better diagnosis of their health issue. And what's more important here is that health insurance agencies are also recognizing these companies and providing reimbursement for them. So this particular article is actually pointing out and talks a little bit about the structural problems in the healthcare system and how technology can actually help it provide fix those issues. For instance, you know, obviously we have public and private insurance industry, as well as the hidden kind of black box costing structure. So if technology would be required to be added into the mix, it could potentially add the ability to measure outcomes as well as costs for every patient and build an information platform centered around the patient, not just practices and specialties. So some of the aspects that they point out is following some principles like making it more patient-focused, more accessible to all involved in the healthcare, having common data definitions across the board, and also an information architecture that's accessible to any application. Of course, also incorporating expert systems to aid in medical professionals in speeding diagnosis. And of course, they said similar things, like for instance, if they were to add in DNA sequencing to help the better diagnosis, would help for a more accurate outcome and also essentially reduce some of the costs. What I do want to discuss is really around some of the transparency some of the health providers have and with the insurance companies, as well as kind of mitigating that black box scenario. Cheever, what do you think? Is this something that is so deep that it's not going to be able to be fixed with just by adding technology into the mix?
You know, my opinion on this whole thing is apologies to Denise Howell and the This Week in Law group. A lot of this is because lawyers have gotten into the mix and the healthcare industry is so concerned about privacy issues that a lot of innovation hasn't happened. And the healthcare industry itself, the instrument makers have had this opinion that, oh, they know how to do this, you know, except they're the ones putting out open Wi-Fi hotspots in, you know, EEG machines so that it's convenient. They added a feature without designing in security. Anyway, so to get to the question is, yeah, there needs to be a lot more transparency. We need to have the ability for insurance companies, healthcare providers, and the patient themselves to be able to exchange information. Things won't change, you know. My big thing, I've actually done some work on some Native American reservations off in the middle of nowhere. And healthcare is a big problem. It's gotten to the point where some of the reservations are so desperate for primary care physicians in their area is that they're actually paying full scholarships for people to go to medical school with the stipulation they come back and provide X number of years at the reservation. Well, one of the things that I think needs to happen is we need to be able to leverage technology. You know, there was I was involved with a project where a dermatologist used a commercial off-the-shelf webcam but fitted a ring light to it so that they'd have a natural balance, and they'd use that for wound care. Big deal. You know, why should someone have to drive 100 miles to go and Oh, yeah, that looks like it's healing nicely. Change the bandage, go ahead. Those are the things that aren't going to happen if the transparency doesn't start happening. We need people to start talking to each other. We need the insurance companies to open up how they're doing their billing so that a doctor can go and punch, send it in, and the patients will be able to go and have a better understanding, a better breakdown of what they're going in for. You know, right now, if I go in for, say, a colonoscopy, you know, because I'm getting older, I'm not 100% sure it's going to be covered. I always have to go and call my insurance company and say, okay, the healthcare provider thinks it's going to be these codes. What is it going to be? Why shouldn't I be able to go and say, well, if it's this, it's going to be this. It's this, you know, this is just tables, really easy tables. I could go and find out if they find a polyp, this is what it's going to cost. If they don't find a polyp, this is what it's going to cost. This is not that hard. Why isn't it happening? I personally think it's lack of transparency and enough rant. Back to you, Lou.
I mean, I agree. I think to me personally, I think it needs to happen in baby steps. So, for instance, we'll come up with a system for not only billing, what are the companies supposed to be billing and how what's supposed to be covered, that kind of thing. These companies should provide it. And I guess the fact that there are so many companies out there, there might need to be some potential regulation around it so that it causes them to produce these common systems across the board. So what are they supposed to be charging? Like, for instance, what's the retail price versus the discounted price that goes to the provider? And what's actually your copay on these things? So like that kind of thing, it would make it easier to kind of look that up. Like, for instance, I go sometimes and I have a reoccurring fee on some devices that I use at home for medical purposes, and I have to replace filters and stuff on it. And the problem is I don't necessarily always know how much they're going to cost. The price could go up, the price could go down. I don't know how much they're charging the insurance companies on it. I tend to see a kind of a flux even in the bill that I get at home. It would be really nice to be able to say, even if there is a flux, I can go look at it and decide on whether I want to get an update that week or that month. Plus, it would change the way the insurance companies would get billed because there would be a little bit more transparency there. Maybe there would be even more discounted amounts, more price variances, and so on. But again, baby steps. I mean, we need to find a way to provide a system. And I guess the question back to you, Cheever, is it just we need a little bit of government regulation in there to help with that, to kind of force the companies in the right direction?
You know, I hate to say it, but something's got to happen. You know, let's do a short example. The fact of the matter is we still don't have a really, really good way of identifying the patient. You know, it's against the law to use Social Security numbers now. Okay. Well, one of the problems that happened with this is, again, a lack of the ability to have transparency between the insurance company and the healthcare provider is I got this invoice in the mail for the birth of my son. Excuse me, I don't have a son, but it was another Kathy Chi that also lived in Kaneohe because the healthcare provider is not allowed to use Social Security numbers, so they don't have a unique patient identifier that they're so concerned about it that you can't have access to an SSN anymore. So, there's another Kathy. Oh, she lives in Kaneohe. Oh, that must be the one. And I got the bill for obstetrics care for the delivery of a son. Really interesting. So yeah, something's gotta happen. There, I really, really hate to say it, but maybe it really is time for some sort of national ID or something, so that we can use it as an encryption key. You know, get some dual key encryption going there, so that a patient can go and say, scan, yes, you're allowed to send this data between the insurance company and the provider. Scan, yes, unlock that transaction. Scan, yes, unlock that transaction. You know, kind of like maybe a LifeLock for healthcare. You know, oh, I got an app. Oh, okay, well, my insurance company wants the emergency room records. Click, okay, that's pretty good. Yeah, JJ, I know it's not going to be even. You know, there's going to be the disadvantaged, you know, but we've got to, again, like Lou says, take baby steps. We need to start making progress to standardize things enough so that we have less billing errors. Billing errors cost a ton of money. Being able to not have to do paper transactions, be able to do electronic, that saves money. There's a lot of ways for hospitals and healthcare providers to be able to reduce their cost of doing business so they can concentrate on doing healthcare. That's, I think, is the bottom line. We need to get it to the point where doctors and nurses aren't paper pushers. They need to have something faster and easier. I need to be able to have a card or a bracelet or a ring or something that can make it HIPAA compliant so that we can maintain privacy. I go into my healthcare provider and say, for instance, I go and scan. Bling, I just authorized this and I authorized the paper trail. Let's go. PC Guy 8088, yeah, healthcare numbers, sure. a unique identifier. The Social Security number could have worked, but that's illegal now because there's too many things tied to an SSN. Tinkertoy Tech, yeah. Well, we didn't do the story about them putting the RFIDs into the web of your hand for certain employees. Yeah, that'll go over like a lead balloon. So, yeah. There are many things that we need to do. The healthcare industry needs to be a lot more serious about taking the advice of IT people. We need to have IT people like JJ. You know, JJ is over at the Augusta Cybersecurity Institute. We need people with those kinds of skills working directly with the healthcare providers so we can design that types of things in so we can create transparency with security. What do you think, Blue?
Yeah, I think you hit it right on the nose. I think that's the, I mean, you couldn't have said it better. I think, you know, by adding to the transparency, reducing the impedance for people to understand, you know, what the costs are, reducing the concept of what the costs are for insurance companies, it really gives them the ability to focus on what really matters. Like you said, not only health providing, and healthcare, but also customer service and making sure that this is not a issue. It's more of a of an additional service. Kind of move on, but so I think that hopefully that we'll move in baby steps and we'll get there. Well, folks, that does it for the Bites. But when we come back, we get to my favorite part of the show. We get to talk about Black Hat. But first, we couldn't do this Week in Enterprise Tech without the support of our fabulous sponsors. And Leo wants to tell you about one. Leo?
If you don't mind, I'd like to interrupt for a moment, gentlemen, and we'll continue on with this Week in Enterprise Tech. But I want to tell you, enterprise types, about something I didn't know about. Maybe you've heard about it. Amazon Kinesis. This is another one of those great services from AWS. In the information age, data is the new gold, right? The new oil. Businesses need data, and there's no better data than real-time data. You probably already know that. In fact, you probably already are wishing you had it. That's why Amazon Web Services built Amazon Kinesis. It's a powerful way to collect, process, and analyze streaming data so you can get timely insights and react quickly in real time to new information. Websites, mobile apps, IoT sensors all generate huge amounts of live streaming data, right? Sometimes terabytes an hour. If processed in real time, you can really learn a lot about how your customers, your applications, and your products are doing and respond right away. But you need something with the capabilities of handling all that data in real time. Amazon Kinesis lets you do it easily and, yes, at a low cost. That's important, too. With just a few clicks, you can start sending data from this is amazing, really. These guys are incredible. Hundreds of thousands of data sources simultaneously. So, you know, you collect all the data from all your widgets, loading in real time. It lets you process and analyze the data and take actions promptly. All you need to know is SQL. You need to know SQL. And you can query it. And you can build a tool around it easily. Amazon gives you the flexibility to build your own custom applications using popular stream processing frameworks of your choice. And with Kinesis, as always, with AWS, you only pay for what you use. There are no minimums, no upfront commitments. I love AWS. These guys are just knocking it out of the park. Brand new from Amazon. Amazon Kinesis. You want to know more? Go to kinesis.aws and let's get that data streaming. The data must flow. KINESIS.AWS. Kinesis. KINESIS.AWS. That's actually a good name for something that's happening fast and in real time. It's kinetic, right? Kinesis.AWS. We thank Amazon Web Services so much for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And I now send you back to Studio A.
Thanks, Leo. And thanks to AWS for their support. Well, folks, we get to my favorite part of the show. We get to bring in a guest to drop a little bit of knowledge on the Twilight Riot. What's going on in Sin City this week? Well, it's Black Hat and DEF CON, of course. And to walk us through some of what's going on is Senior Security Solutions Architect at F5 Networks, Brian McHenry. Brian focuses on web applications and network security and is regular contributor on InformationSecurityBuzz.com and a co-founder of B-Sides New York City, as well as a speaker at AppSec USA, GoSec Montreal, and Central Ohio InfoSec Summit, and many more. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Lou. It's been a real treat listening to you guys talk about stuff that I'm interested in. So now I get to chime in. And fortunately, I can call back some things that you started off with and relate it to my experience at Black Hat.
Fantastic. Yeah, well, we definitely want to hear what's going on, especially how you're surviving in Sin City this week, and whether you're able to use a mobile device without fear. But we definitely want to get into that and talk a little bit about just what are you seeing, what's going on, you know, what's kind of the themes that you're seeing across the board.
Top themes, just tons of stuff about endpoint security. So if you're on the vendor floor, it seems like everybody's talking about endpoint security. Just before Black Hat kicked off, we heard news that Cisco is acquiring Observable Networks, an endpoint security firm that has a technology that's flow-based, looking at network flows. We had big news from Microsoft right before Black Hat about their new real-time cloud-based malware, anti-malware scanning that's related to the Windows Defender suite. And that's certainly carried over right into Black Hat. Tons of new vendors popping up, existing vendors rolling out new solutions. And then, as is you might expect at Black Hat, is there's a number of talks telling you that endpoint security doesn't work, that there's malware that can bypass things, everything that's out on the market today. So not much has changed at Black Hat thematically, but it has gotten huge. If you've been on Twitter or anywhere this week, you saw the opening keynote. It was full-on rock concert arena style. There was smoke, there was lasers. I'm pretty sure there were ninjas and unicorns as well.
Fantastic. So I think one thing that maybe just, I mean, sure people are aware of it, but just in case our audience is not, can you just give us what Black Hat is, what DEF CON is, and kind of what the difference is and what people kind of focus on there?
So here's the Black Hat program guide, and you can see the event guide is pretty thick. You can attend a lot of sessions at Black Hat. Black Hat is started out, and this is Black Hat 20. So this is the 20th Black Hat this year, kind of a milestone, if you will. And Black Hat is really more vendor-driven, more solutions and enterprise tech-driven, even though there is that sort of hacker, how do I bypass things, how do I exploit things. There's definitely a theme of Black Hat. DEF CON is sort of where everybody kind of goes DIY. After Black Hat's over, after we've kind of done all of our day job kind of stuff, DEF CON kicks in at the end of the week, and it's much more DIY oriented, much more, you know, sort of grassroots, like really hands-on kind of, and maybe a little bit more off the beaten path. And maybe not to give it short shrift, at the preceding Black Hat and DEF CON, the security B-size Las Vegas also happens. And that's started off, the security B-size actually started off, if it was around the RSA conference or around Black Hat and DEF CON. But the idea of security B-size is that there's so many talks and cool pieces of research that get submitted to, say, Black Hat or DEF CON or the RSA conference that, hey, there's a lot of good stuff that gets rejected, a lot of stuff that maybe doesn't quite fit the theme of the conference. So the B-side of those conferences is the B-side's experience. So B-side starts off the week in Sin City, continues with Black Hat, which is a really more the enterprise flavor of security. And then we move into DEF CON, where it's a little bit more chaotic, a little bit more of a free-for-all. I myself am in Miami at the moment. I left Black Hat last night and had to hightail it to another location to do my job for F5.
Fantastic. So a little bit about, you talked a little bit about how there is endpoint security. That was kind of the common theme. Was it focusing at any points in the industry? You said, obviously, you had some examples there about, Microsoft and so on. But was it focusing, there was any like vendors or topics focusing on like healthcare or any particular parts of the industry? It was just overall endpoint security.
It was really overall. There was everybody had a take on it. There were vendors there and researchers there talking about endpoint security around medical devices, just as they were talking about it for mobile devices, desktops, laptops, all that kind of stuff. So it's certainly all over the map, and it's not just malware. There's a big emphasis on ransomware. I had the privilege of sitting down with Jeremiah Grossman, the founder of White Hat Security. Now he's with Sentinel One, and they have a really unique solution for detecting malware in real time and stopping it before it can actually encrypt the files. So that way, you know, you actually can kind of, it's making copies. I'm probably doing a disservice, but it's kind of copying the data before it gets encrypted, so that you have sort of a fallback. So a lot of innovative solutions out there, a lot of things being presented around, you know, how to detect malware, how to bypass detection, how to, you know, detect when your malware has been, you know, is being detonated, so to speak, in a sandbox. So there's a lot of interesting research as well as solutions and products on display at Black Hat.
So hey, Brian.
Go ahead, Brian. Yeah.
Dude, I'm dying to know. I saw some pictures and animations from a friend that was working the Black Hat conference. Apparently, ETS did an amazing job, total rock concert level. But
yeah,
content-wise, did you make it to the keynote? What were they talking? What was the keynote people talking about this year?
So I made it to the opening keynote, and it was really busy. Alex Stamos, CISO from Facebook, previously of Yahoo, I believe. But I've seen Alex speak a few times before. There's been a real big shift in a lot of these keynotes, and I've seen it from a couple of different speakers. But Alex really hit it on the head. And one of the things I took away from it was really have to focus more on safety. We have to approach our practice as security professionals as less the militaristic paradigm. You know, attack and defense, you know, higher walls, more guns, and really look at it. Hey, people need to exist on the internet in a variety of different ways, for work, for healthcare, for their personal lives, for privacy. And privacy, you know, often boils down to safety. But now we're getting into the world that, you know, you talk about IoT. You guys mentioned, you know, hacking cars. This is a matter of public safety. Whether it's in our personal lives or it's in our professional lives as IT and security practitioners, we have an opportunity, a really unique opportunity to affect the safety of the internet and to be better and more, you know, conscious internet citizens. And so that was one of the things that I've taken away from a number of talks, but Alex really focused on that. The other thing that Alex talked about was really being more inclusive in how you know, we approach the job. So, you know, treat everyone, you know, that we come across, you know, regardless of race, gender, creed, religion, treat them all as equals and as somebody that has something to offer, a unique perspective that's going to help us on this journey and this goal of making the internet a safer place. So pretty powerful. You know, once you strip away all the lasers and the smoke and all the cool stuff that ETS did, There was some really good content in that keynote that I think everybody could probably get on board with at least some of it.
Okay. You were obviously having a great time. I saw we did a Skype test from the show floor.
Yeah.
What kinds of cool things did you see from the show floor? Because that's actually where I think I learned the most at Black Hat. It's all the new gadgets and gadgets and widgets that the guys on the show floor show off.
So these guys, this is Carbon Black's thing. It's not really meant to be a plug, but my son's into Minecraft, so I had to take one of their freebies, some of their swag. So all kinds of cool stuff on the show floor. That's something that's really changed over the last few years. It used to be that all the good content was really you know, in the briefings that get accepted. Everybody submits talks, and there's really good briefings. All the content's there. A lot of the vendors have taken to, and F5 was among them, of having these sort of lightning chats right in their booth, you know, and seating areas, and you could sit down and learn about anything. And the good vendors, the ones that were really cool, were just, some of them were just presenting research. They weren't pitching product. They were just showing you what they were learning about, what they too were finding, and so it wasn't necessarily a you know, a product pitch, you know. So there was a lot of that too. So you could sit down in the booth and get product pitched to you in these presentations. But there was a lot of really cool stuff of, you know, how, you know, what they were doing, you know, what some of the, you know, their actual developers and support engineers from these different vendors saying, hey, here's some, here's a side project that I have, you know, at you know, F5, for example, about how I, set up a honey net. And, you know, some people are curious about that, right? You hear about honey nets that are used to collect threat data. How do you build that? How, you know, what's the mechanism for doing that? And there's some really good information out on the show floor. And I think if you ever go to Black Hat or one of these conferences, you know, scrutinize, you know, look for the vendors that are sharing some meatier information, rather than just, you know, looking to sell you something.
So, dude, one of my other favorite things to do at Black Hat, definitely DEF CON, but that also at Black Hat, is people watching. So Emily Lestrange in the chat room will say, well, this is all good, fine and good, talking about safety and designing things in and all this stuff. But the guys that sit on the purse strings, the finance guys, the CTOs, the CEOs, and so forth, the C-suite folks, they're not getting the word. However, one of the huge things that I've noticed that's the difference between Black Hat and DEF CON is Black Hat actually has C-suite people showing up at the show.
Yeah.
I've seen that in the past. Were you doing some people watching? What kinds of people did you see?
Well, we saw, you know, so I definitely had some, you know, I went to some briefings. I went to as many as I could, but I showed you that thick book. You can't possibly make it to all of them. So sometimes you go to a briefing because you want to see a certain person speak. Sometimes you go to a briefing because the content's really interesting. And sometimes you – and it can be very hit or miss. But in when I was in the booth and doing my duty, we actually had – you know, we had some C-suite people come up. But we also had some people – you know, we had some very interesting people. You know, you got to be careful. Sometimes you get these financial analysts that come in. They're very – they try to be very incognito, and they're trying to get information out of you about your company. So that's always fun. And then we actually we definitely had the requisite, you know, Mohawks walking by. But one of the things that I saw that was really from a people watching perspective, somebody was actually monetizing their Mohawk. They actually had like ad space. There was a vendor advertising. They had like these probably 2 foot tall Mohawks, I guess it wasn't very effective advertising because I can't remember what vendor it was that had printed their logo on these people's Mohawks as they walked the show floor. But yeah, it's definitely some interesting stuff. At the same time, again this year at Black Hat, there was also the Super Zoo convention, which is apparently a big pet merchandise convention. So it's definitely, you know, I actually saw dogs with dyed green and pink Mohawks. So there's some people watching and dog watching as well.
So Brian, what were some of the kind of the better hacks that you saw that were kind of presented there? Do you have any specific that kind of stick out in your mind?
So one of the cool things I went to a talk and I tweeted about it as an exploit kit cornucopia, and it was presented by some of the folks researchers over at Cisco Umbrella. That's their their new sort of cloud security offering. They scooped up OpenDNS as part of that. And some really interesting things about, how drive-by malware, so-called drive-by malware, propagates, and then how to sort of, dig in again, a little bit along the lines of setting up honey nets and that sort of thing, how to set up scrapers to go and seek out and find these drive-by malware sites. And one of the surprising things was they pointed out that, you kind of look at the SSL top 1 million sites as being more or less reputable. There's a fair and I wish I had the numbers in front of me, but a sort of surprising percentage of that SSL top million infected, compromised. You probably need to not go there. And so that was pretty interesting. The other most interesting talk I went to was somewhat non-technical in nature. It was presented by the folks at the Carnegie Mellon Cyber Labs. I hope I'm getting that right. And her name was Lori Craner, I believe. And I should have reviewed my notes a little bit more closely before I got on with you guys. But suffice it to say, really, really interesting talk. about security usability testing, about how to roll out how when we roll out a new security control, what's the response from the user base? So looking at things, so they looked at the rollout of two-factor authentication at Carnegie Mellon and did a study on the usability of two-factor. You know, we're always told to use two-factor. That's what we should do. That's the smart thing to do. But when you actually roll it out, very few people do a study on how usable it is and how people respond to it. So some really interesting data there. They also studied, password policies, and they were using Amazon's Mechanical Turk to do a lot of automated testing. So they got really good sample sizes as a result in these tests. So looking everything from basic 8 to comprehensive 16 password policies and seeing, we all have a basic notion, right? The more complex the password policy, the more annoying and less usable it is. But there were some interesting data points in there where there was some happy mediums that you could kind of find with your password policy. One of the other things they also looked at was phishing. And this was a really cool test they set up. They talked about the ethical implications of security usability testing, right? You have to be careful that you don't do anything that actually harms the user. But you also have to, kind of set up realistic attack scenarios, right? You can't test how effective a security and how usable a security control is if the user knows they're being observed, kind of that, Heisenberg uncertainty kind of thing. And so they did this test, and they wanted to see how people responded to security warnings. And so they told the users that they were doing this online shopping survey. And so they told them to go buy some paperclips on Amazon. And then what happened was they would send them a survey after the fact about their online shopping experience. But what they did as part of that survey is they also sent them an email saying, oh, we need to refund you some money about this transaction. And it was actually a phishing email. So they phished their survey respondents, and they didn't even – it was very simple text. The cool thing here was a couple thousand users, very simple text message, text-formatted email message, and the URL that they were using was amazonaccounts.net. And it was transparent. You didn't have to hover over to see that it was not amazon.com. And upwards of 90% of people clicked on that phishing link and ignored all the browsers that had blacklisted this domain and said that this was, they went straight through and they hosted this domain and watched people, basically would say that, oh, I'll just keep clicking it until it goes away. They don't even look at it. So very interesting to see data that backs up sort of what we intuitively know, and started to give some hints about maybe some of the things to think about in terms of usability and looking for different ways of putting in better security controls that people won't abandon your application or using whatever your service is because your security control is too onerous.
Okay, so gotta ask. There are some real, real high profile things that were highlighted. I'm gonna ask Kevin to go to a ZDNet article. Yep. And so they're talking about some of the best hacks. I'm actually, we had some people asking, what about the car wash hack? Did you get to see that? Or did you get to see the ATM hack that was spewing cash out?
So I didn't see that. I saw that the ATM hack a few years ago. That was several years ago. That was an interesting one. I've also we also saw a cool one a few years back that was the million browser botnet, and basically for a few hundred dollars of ad revenue, they were able to inject JavaScript into browsers like all over the world that could easily mount a massive DDoS attack. Which, only a few months later, we saw, the Baidu ad networks do that kind of thing. So I did, I've probably got to attend four briefings over 2 days between my own presenting responsibilities and manning the booth for F5. So, I don't know if I saw any of the ones that made anybody's list, but I did get to see some pretty cool stuff.
So yeah, I think some of the other ones that they were asking about here is the fruit fly or the near undetectable backdoor for your Mac, and of course the FBI takedown of the notorious Avalanche botnet. Any of these kind of ring a bell? And I think some of the people were talking about wanting to know more information about that.
Yeah, takedown of the Avalanche botnet was one that I talked to some people that attended that session. It wasn't really a botnet. It was a pretty massive undertaking, they really walked through, you know, sort of how they went about threat hunting, and really what it comes down to. And so every one of these, the cool things that I saw, it wasn't down to like really advanced technologies. You'd go in, it has like this real, all these talks have really sexy titles. But what it boils down to is smart and dedicated people doing good work. Either in research or analysis or, forensics and detection and so on. I hate to be the buzzkill, but it comes down to people, not tech, in terms of doing a good job of security. And, that's the thing that I'm interested in is, one of the reasons I got involved with B-Sides was I wanted to be a part of, attracting more and more people to this field of study and field of work that I find, endlessly interesting over the last 20 or so years of my life.
Right. Yeah. You're only as good as your weakest link, which is most of the time people. So it's unfortunate. So you haven't told us. I guess you did some presenting as well on the F5 booth. What did? What kind of stuff were you presenting about? Kind of to the audience.
So we had a couple of sponsored sessions. Last year at F5, we finally said, after lots of years of me asking, I've been at F5 coming up on 10 years after a long career in IT. And I've been asking for a long time with this. Like, I know we have all these smart security researchers who help us build our security solutions. We should really give them more of a platform to share this kind of information. And we launched f5labs.com last year, right at the end of 2016. And we're churning out all kinds of interesting stuff on there, everything from interesting reports and articles, responses to, stuff that's in the news, as well as our own original research, things that we found with our research and data collection. And so the two things that we had big sponsored workshop sessions on, one was global encryption trends, and you may have seen what we call the TLS telemetry report, just looking at the change and adoption of different HTTPS protocols, ciphers, and so on. That was presented by my friend David Holmes, who does quite a bit of writing for Dark Reading and Security Week and those types of outlets. Then what I got to do was work with our researchers at F5 Labs on IoT threat hunting. And we're about to release volume 3 of our IoT threat hunting report. We've been releasing them about every 6 months now. And really looking at trends in, how these botnets are getting built on IoT devices. So just prior, our first, and it was one of those things where we published our first volume just before the Mirai botnet went wild. And we noted, like, hey, there's this big 140% spike in telnet scans of looks like internet cameras. And we couldn't tell what was going on. Our sensor network was picking up all these scans on Telnet, and I find that endlessly interesting as someone who was standing up firewalls in the 90s and explicitly blocking things like Telnet and SSH, anything that had a command interface. So that was the whole real reason why we have firewalls is to block stuff like that. But here we are, we're seeing these massive Telnet scans. Like 140% spikes, month over month kind of thing. And then, right after we published that report, the Mirai botnet did the thing it did with, I think it was the 400 gigabit attack. And, later on, we saw over 1 terabit attack. So we really interesting data around, these IoT botnets and how they're getting built, and trying to suss out exactly, are there trends that we can use to kind of give us forewarning. And that's the thing right now that we see is we're about to publish the Volume 3 report. And you may have heard about the PerSerai botnet, which is many times larger than the Mirai botnet. And we're a little concerned because there's a lot of other scanning infectious activity that we're not sure what's going on, because we don't see corresponding sort of attacks being launched out of those networks. So we don't know if there's something going on that and there's maybe a bigger attack coming of some sort, a bigger botnet being built that doesn't have a fancy name assigned to it yet.
Right. It's always those secret ones coming out of nowhere that kind of gets us off guard. Unfortunately, we've run out of time, and it just goes so fast sometimes. Yeah. Brian, we really appreciate you being on the show, being eyes and ears at Black Hat and DEF CON. Thank you so much for coming. Can you tell the audience a little bit about where they can find you, your work, and a little bit more about maybe the Black Hat and events and some of the other trade shows?
Anything that has security in the name of the conference, you'll be able to find me usually. I'll either be submitting a talk, trying to present there, or just attending and trying to get a little bit smarter than I am today. I am a co-founder of B-Sides NYC. We do have a date lockdown, which is January 20th. 2018, and that'll be the second edition. We skipped a year due to some venue challenges, but we're very, very happy to have the College of Digital Forensics at John Jay to host us once again. And these guys are it's really, really nice space, and we'll have three tracks once again. Lockpick Village, we'll have all kinds of fun stuff there. In a more official capacity with F5, I do have a monthly column on informationsecuritybuzz.com, and my effort there is to try to simplify the jargon that's out there and tell you what I'm seeing as I travel around, talk to F5 customers, talk to our product teams, and hopefully be a part of that good internet citizenship, and hopefully make it a safer place. And my Twitter handle is BA McHenry, so my middle name is Alexander, if you're wondering what that A is for. So it's BAM, and so BA McHenry on Twitter, and you can find me there.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming, and we'll definitely have to have you back, especially after all of those events, so we'll hear a little bit about the outcomes of them. So thanks so much.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate you giving me a little bit of time to talk, and now I got to get out the door here in Miami and go meet with some more F5 customers.
Sounds good. Thanks again, Brian. Well, folks, you've done it again. You've used up another hour of the best dang enterprise show, according to 9 out of 10 endpoint security firms. But, of course, I have to thank my co-host in crime and our tireless producer, Mr. Brian Chee. Chiebert, can you tell the folks at home where they can find you, where they can find all your work?
Well, I am Chiebert at Twit TV, or Twitter handle is ADVNETLAB. And by the way, everybody, happy sysadmin day. Wow.
Absolutely. And we can't do without those sysadmins. Well, you've done it again. And of course, I want you to thank all of you as well, our tireless, our wonderful listeners. You tune in each and every week. We couldn't do this show without you. And if you continue to want to see enterprise goodness from This Week in Enterprise Tech, we want you to subscribe. We wanted to make it easy for you and for you to get your enterprise information each and every week. So go out to the show page, twit.tv/twiet, where you'll find all our back episodes, full show notes, links, and information about our guests, as well as, more importantly, next to the videos over there, you see those magic buttons, the subscribe button, in order to choose your format of your choice, whether it's audio, video, HD video, and a device of your choice, whether it's phone, tablet, laptop, or desktop. Also, don't be afraid to share Twiet with your friends and family who may want to learn about tech and a little bit of enterprise tech. And also remember, we do the show live each and every week at Friday, 1:30 Pacific time. And you can come and watch us live at live.twit.tv. And if you want to watch us live, you might as well jump in to the live chat room as well. It's irc.twit.tv. each and every week. And we tend to have pretty great discussions. In fact, a ton of great discussions this week in the chat room. We were able to have some great discussions about Black Hat and some of the other topics we went on. Also, come and visit us there and check out and give some of your thoughts as well. Don't forget to follow me at Twitter, twitter.com/LouMM, where you can find all the cool things that I'm working on, as well as pitch some show notes, pitch some show ideas to me as well. We can see what we can get on. Also, don't forget to go to dev.office.com and graph.microsoft.io. That's where all my work. You can find all of my demos and my work that my team kind of outputs from there. Also, I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. Of course, especially to Leo and Lisa, who support us each and every week for this week in Enterprise Tech, allowing us to do it. Also, thank you to all the engineers at Twit that make this show possible. And of course, thank you to our tireless producer, Mr. Brian Chi. And of course, thank you to my TD, Kevin, the Shark Man himself. Kevin, can you tell the folks at home what it is you're doing over there?
I'm bringing the Shark Week to Twit.
Definitely the Shark Man. Thank you, Kevin. Of course, we hope you come back next week to have some more enterprise goodness. And until next time, I'm Louis Baraska, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.